thank you guys for all coming. I really appreciate this. As you probably know, a year ago was Joe Simon's last convention appearance. And he came to this convention by dint of absolute iron will. It was an amazing thing to see. It was just a little over a month later that he passed away. And right until the end, it was really astonishing because Joe lived for his work. And we had nothing but fun the entire time. It was just astonishing. And I admired him. I will do this occasionally. I admired him so much. And I feel like he's here now. He probably is, and he's probably saying, "Steve, get moving, just stop with the bullshit." I think that's safe, yeah. But we've come here to basically appreciate him. He was just a joy to be with and a joy to see. And I've got a wonderful panel of people, and I'm going to mostly just let them loose. I will ask a few pointed questions, and they can make up any answer they want to, because Joe was the perfect person to say, never let the facts get in the way of a good story. I'm going to start with Angelo Torres. Is one of the most wonderful artists in the history of comics. He worked with Joe on so many wonderful projects, and I have just met him, and I can't even begin to express the honor to him of just having met him. The guy next to him I've been honored to know for quite a long time. That's Paul Levitz. Paul was the publisher of DC Comics for many years. And when Paul met Joe, Paul was pretty much a kid in knee pants at DC Comics, and Joe was already a seasoned veteran. This is one of the best artists of the history of comics today and for many years. This is Mr. Dave Gibbons. This would be one of Joe's closest collaborators. This would be Mr. Jim Simon. And this woman helped to keep Joe going for a long time. This is Joe's granddaughter, Emily Groban, and she probably saw more of Joe the last couple of years than any of us, and you really need to give her a serious applause. This is an amazing group of people, and they represent an amazing individual. What I'd like to start with is asking, starting with Angelo, how they came to know Joe, what some of the best memories of Joe are, and whether or not they are publishable, or if we have to turn off the camera.
Should I stand or just?
You can sit if you'd like to. I'm just obnoxious.
I'm an 80-year-old guy, and for me to sit here and say that I grew up with Simon and Kirby sounds a little strange. But I did. At the age of 9, I was in love with Captain America and the Boy Commandos and all those characters that they created. So when I got the phone call in around 1959 from Joe asking me if I wanted to work on The Fly, I was just thrilled to death. And I met him. I thought it was one of the most wonderful people I've ever met in this business. And I went to work on The Fly. I did a couple of Fly stories for him. And one day he approached me and he said, "I want to do a humor magazine, like Mad, you know." So I said, "Well, let's talk about it, and I'll get some guys." And I got Archie Goodwin and his roommate Jerry, and we sat around and hashed this thing out. And Joe was the Jules Pfeiffer strip 666 was very big then in the Village Voice, and Joe said, "I want to do this kind of humor. You know, this kind of offbeat stuff." And I said, "Well, fine, let's see what we can come up with." And we boiled it down to one sick instead of three because we couldn't use the 666. So we said, "Let's make it one sick." And I sat down with Archie Goodwin and Jerry and a couple of other people, and we dummied up the first issue of...
Jerry DeFuccio?
No, Jerry Pruitt was Archie Goodwin's roommate at that time. Archie wasn't married then. And we put together a dummy of Sick, and Joe took it to the publisher, and the magazine was born in 1960. I think the first issue was in August of 60. Well, I ended up working for the next 7 years on SICK with Joe. I had moved to Pennsylvania, so I used to drive in and bring my pages in and spend a great couple of hours with Joe every couple of weeks. And he loved my stuff, and I loved working with him. He was one of the finest people I've ever known in this business. And I'm ever grateful that I got to meet him and work with him. And always remembering that, you know, I idolized he and Jack over the years. I was a big fan, and I'm still thrilled that I got to work with Joe all those years. Unfortunately, after I left SICK, I didn't see much of Joe after that, and I'm sorry, I have to say that I didn't see him for over 50 years, but I kept up with what he was doing, and I'm just very, very grateful that I got to know Joe and the fine person that he was.
Paul, you're up.
Next up.
As a reader, I got to know Joe from Brother Power the Geek, of all unlikely places. That came out when I was about, I guess, 11 years old. And I was a pretty dyed-in-the-wool DC fan at that period, because my mother only let me buy a few comic books a week, so it wouldn't corrupt me too much. And there was always enough DCs to buy, so I hadn't really gotten into Marvel yet at that stage. And this was the strangest-looking thing DC had ever done, I felt. Very captivating. I was a big fan of it. Joe's work with Jerry Brandinetti, I guess, at the time. And really, the next I knew of Joe, I was 16, freshly starting to freelance for DC, and I'd written a couple letter columns, and I had just gotten the assignment to write the first of a new series of bullpen pages for DC. It was going to be called Behind the Scenes. And Sol Harrison, who was my client, I guess, within DC, who had commissioned the work, says, look, your first one, we want you to write about this new book that we're putting out. We really think this is going to be the book that's going to change the industry. It's going to be the most important thing since Superman. But nobody's read it. You're going to be the first one outside, about three or four of us, to have read it. So you got to sit here and you got to write your whole column in the production department in DC. Bring the book out, you can sit at a drawing board, you can read it here, and they bring out press number one. I'm 16, I'm kind of looking around at everybody and says, you know, this is kind of strange stuff. Okay, these guys are all my father's age. They've been in the business forever. They say this is going to change the business. Maybe they're right. And I somehow managed to write that first column and figure out how to get it plugged. It certainly was a very experimental piece of work, much the same way that The Geek had been in my childhood. Unfortunately, it was not the comic that changed the business. But it was indicative, I think, of Joe's lifetime of courage. And whether it's the story Angela was just telling about SICK, or the attitude that Joe and Jack had back in the 1940s when they didn't feel they were getting the right deal at Marvel, so they just walked across the street to DC. When DC wasn't working, they went and struck a deal with Crestwood to publish their own stuff in their own way. He always wanted to find the way to do the thing that hadn't been done before and do it the way he wanted. And shortly after the Prez column experience, I got to actually meet him in the flesh. And I guess that's 40 years ago, and I knew him through the whole 40 years off and on for conversations about projects in the office. And then after he and I didn't have that common connection, talking about projects like the books he was doing with Steve, or even working, probably the most famous connection we had, and there's another guy in the room who had a little more to do with it than I did, was getting to run Joe's original character design for Captain America on the front cover of the New York Con program book. And what year was that, Nick? 1973? 72. I don't think it was 72. I didn't do this 72 book. Maybe 73. Nick Pappas from the original Phil Suling Comic Convention Committee, back when comic conventions had 3,000 people rather than 3 million people attending them. And that was the first time anybody had seen that piece of work. And Nick and Phil dragged it out of Joe's studio and got it out there. So I worked with him in just a wide variety of situations, and unfailingly a cheerful gentleman with an optimistic view of the world. What a pleasure to do business with.
I want to point out something. You talk about being ahead of the curve, though. It's true that both Brother Power the Geek and Prez had relatively short lives. But the fascinating thing about those is that they were among projects that inspired a guy who's done a lot of work these days, and were both incorporated into stories done by Neil Gaiman over the last few years. So, weirdly enough, maybe they didn't inspire millions of readers, but I think they did inspire a few key readers to do some very different stuff.
Sure. What's that?
Your turn.
Okay, well, I'm here really as a fan. It's weird. Growing up in England, we used to get American comic books in black and white reprints, and they'd be jumbled together with no particular coherence of publisher or original printing date or anything. And it's only in retrospect that I realised that a lot of the things I really loved as a kid were things that Joe had had a hand in. You know, foremost amongst them was the Harvey comic, Race for the Moon, which he did with Jack Kirby. And I know Al Williamson inked a lot of Kirby's work there. And I don't know if Angelo did. Did you have a hand in Race for the Moon?
No.
But it was this wonderful amalgamation of excellent artists and great stories. And also a sense of, I think, kind of graphic design, which Joe brought to the work that he put together. And there's one particular image. There was a story called Space Garbage. And the splash panel still haunts me to this day. And it haunted me so much when I was a kid that when we got a chance at school to have free art period, draw whatever you like, I got a big bit of grey kind of sugar paper and some paints and mixed them up. And the teacher came over and said, that's unusual, David. What's that? I said, oh, it's a man in a spacesuit shackled to an asteroid. He's about to die. And there were these, it was a thing that I'd never seen in science fiction before, a really kind of gutsy feeling, a really kind of, you know, two-fisted, bare-knuckle kind of aspect to the stories that Joe had a hand in. I think the first time I ever saw a Golden Age comic was a reproduction of an Adventure Comics with Manhunter, which was one of Simon and Kirby's, I think, original things they did for DC back then, with this huge figure of Manhunter standing over tiny people running in panic in a New York street. Just again, another completely haunting image. And then finally, when American comics did come to Britain, I was fascinated by... was it Private Strong?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, which was the Shield, essentially. But this wonderful notion of a kind of a film strip running down the side of the cover with a kind of stop motion and animation thing. And The Fly, which I'm interested to hear that Angelo worked on as well. These really kind of offbeat things, not perhaps as offbeat as Brother Power or Prayers, you know, but a strangeness, a peculiarity to the things that Joe had a hand in. And also, I'd have to say, amongst superhero costumes, maybe Superman to one side, because he was the first, Captain America's is the best superhero costume, I think. And for the first time I saw it, I would draw it in my sketchbook, just because it was such a lovely thing to draw. So as I say, I speak really as a fan, but although I never met Joe, I did get to speak to him. I was kind of ambushed slightly. I was at the San Diego Comic Con, it must have been last year. It was this year, 2012.
No, it was last year.
See, we're all getting older. I was saying to Steve, you know, that I've met many of my idols in the world of comic books, but much though I loved, you know, Joe's work, I never met him, and it was a shame it didn't look like I was going to be in New York. And Steve kind of nodded, and I carried on talking to somebody else. And Steve handed me his cell phone and said, oh, Dave, it's Joe Simon, if you'd like to talk to him. And Joe was very gracious, and I think he knew who I was, and I had a very brief conversation with him. And so thanks to Steve, I was able to tick off another true great of comic books that I otherwise wouldn't have had a chance to even marginally meet.
Yeah.
And you've forgiven me for it, yes.
Oh, yeah, Steve, I thank you for it very much.
And also, to let you know, one of the cool things about all of the Race for the Moon stuff, and even the Private Strong and the Fly, Joe kept wonderful archives of the original artwork, and so we were able to reproduce the Fly and Private Strong from original art in the superhero book. But in the upcoming science fiction book, we're going to have 80 pages of stories reproduced from the original artwork, and it's never had the opportunity to be published on nice paper like this before, much less with that kind of clarity. Joe loved seeing the stuff with the bright colors and the vivid blacks. He just loved the new books because he felt like he was able to see it sort of again for the first time.
And I'd also like to say that Steve and Nick Landau were kind enough to let me write the introduction to the science fiction volume, and that's a kind of fanboy dream come true as well.
Now, we're all fanboys up here talking about this guy who it's like, holy crap, can we actually believe that we actually ever met him? I can tell you comfortably that having talked to Joe's kids over the years, I know that being Joe's kids had ups and downs all the time, because you just can't have a parent without having, you know, the kind of a relationship a parent-child has. But Jim had the advantage over the years of working with his father, including on a seminal work, the Comic Book Makers. And Jim, I just would sort of like to talk to you about, you know, what was it like working with Joe? And you can leave out the violence.
Well, it's, you know, it's this is kind of emotional for me to talk about Joe. So I'm going to probably ramble a bit. As a matter of fact, my son, he's 9 years old. He wrote me a cartoon that says, "Keep your mouth shut." Mainly that you don't go all over the place.
Although it appears that he's picked up some of the artistic...
Oh, he loved Joe, and Joe loved him. And Joe was a great... You know, he loved to see people try to express talent. And he wasn't the greatest of teachers, because he had very high expectations. And it had to be his way most of the time. But... You look back and you see why. He was truly an artist. And even Jack Kirby said Joe's layouts were just terrific. The best layouts he's ever seen. And he told me, I wanted to be an artist when I was a kid. He gave me a pencil. He says, draw something. Took the pencil away from me. He says, find another profession. He said, become an accountant. Accountants know where the publishers hide the money. So he was pretty funny too. But we worked quite a bit together. We had a lot of disagreements. We'd have meetings. There was one meeting with Jerry Grandinetti, with Joe and myself, and I got very flustered, got up, left the apartment, the studio, and didn't come back for 2 days. I came back, no problem. You know, Joe is a very giving person, and I really miss him a lot. I do want to say, I wish he had created me the way he created Captain America. Why I didn't get that body, I don't know.
Jim, sorry about that. You really want the steroids.
Well, who knows what it was back then. Angelo, Joe loved your work.
Oh, thank you.
And I loved your work too, especially Sick Magazine. I mean, you just had a way of capturing faces, movements, and that, you know, Sick Magazine was one of his favorite publications, And Paul, he had so much respect for you, for what you did for the creators, giving, trying to get them rights. And as a young man coming up to him with your fanzine, what was it?
Comic Reader.
And you were one of the few people he talked to because he had such respect for you in those early days. So, I can go on, but I'll let Steve, well, as my son says, I should shut up.
Well, I can help Jim out here a little bit, because Joe once told me that his mother loved to sing. And apparently she was fairly good, but he couldn't see it. It sounded like caterwauling to him. But she just loved it, and she would sing, I think, opera. And at one point, she wanted him to sing. So they're in the car, and she says, okay, come on, you know, sing for me. It was the last time she ever asked. She pretty well gave up on that whole idea after that one try. So, Jim, you were not the only person who was told you should find another profession. And that was a pretty amazing time, too, because Joe grew up before and during the Great Depression. And he actually had to go into the business right out of high school to help support the family. And he has a lot of really good memories of his parents. But it was, as far as I can tell, the Simon family has always been a very interesting family.
Very interesting.
Now, Emily had an extraordinary experience very recently, because what you may not know is that Joe Simon's crime book, the Simon and Kirby Library Crime, actually hit the New York Times list last October. So at the age of 97, Joe Simon was a New York Times bestseller. But what's better even than hitting the list, so here, let me let Emily tell the story.
Okay. I just want to warn you, this actually might be a little bit emotional for me, too. So I just want to apologize in advance if I ramble. But, yeah, I remember, I think it was you who emailed us the list. I'm pretty sure it was you. And he was sleeping at the time. And I really wanted him to see it. So what I did was I printed it out, I circled it, highlighted it, and I went into his room. And I went up to him, I was like, Daddy Joe, we used to call him Daddy Joe, we didn't call him Grandpa. I was like, Daddy Joe, you have to see this, you have to see this. So he's, whoa, you know, doing that whole thing. Puts on his glasses, goes, ooh! And I swear, I have never seen an old person sit up that fast in my life. But he was so proud. And then he always used to call everyone, this is Joe Simon, New York Times best-selling author. I wanted to know, blah, blah, blah. But I have to say, I think a lot of times people often forget that public figures are people too, and that they have families and they have friends, because people always used to ask me what it was like to have him as a grandfather. And honestly, he was just my grandfather. Like, I didn't think of him that way. And I don't know. I just forgot what I was going to say. But what?
Let Jim say something.
Add to that.
Yeah.
You know, I worked with him on a lot of the comic books, especially after Sick. I really got involved with Sick because I was about 9, 10 years old when he started Sick. And he was a very up-to-the-minute person. He was always looking at the kids and what the kids were doing, and he would turn those into great stories. He wasn't a fuddy-duddy. You know, he didn't look back. He looked forward. And he would treat the family like me. He would always ask my opinion. And I would write stories, and he would reject them, and rewrite them again. But he was teaching me. And he treated his family that way. He loved his family. He could be, you know, kind of tough with us. And sometimes I've heard him talk to Steve on the phone in the tone that he would sometimes talk to me when he got flustered. And I've often told Steve, now you're Joe's son. I don't know how you put up with it. But Steve is much more able to, I guess, accommodate and handle Joe better than I was.
I deal with writers. You deal with writers, you got to be part editor, part psychologist. But actually, Joe did have a secret as to how he stayed current. He had other children, including three daughters. And he had three teenage daughters at pretty much the same time, which proves a certain amount of strength and survivability. But he had two daughters who were twins, and they would go with him to the mall, and they would go disappearing. One would disappear and the other would be with him. And he'd be like, okay, so, Lori, where's Gail? And Lori would be like, she's in the shoe store. And they'd go to the shoe store, and there she was. These are telepathic children. Now, a parent of a telepathic child is really seriously outnumbered. And for just a second, though, I would like them to stand up, please. I'm not going to make you talk, but stand up, please. Now you know why I'm hoping that there's a door out the back here, because I don't think I can make it to that door alive now.
Over there.
Well, there we go.
And getting back to family, as Steve pointed out, Emily was a great help to my father. But I want to really show my appreciation to Lori. She really, really took care of my father when he was ill. And I don't know if she realizes how much I appreciate it. We had a lot of fights over my father's health and how he should be taken care of. But I give her a tremendous credit for what she went through.
So now I'm going to start back down with Angelo again. Angelo, when you were working with Joe on Sick,
yeah.
What was it like? You guys had some very strange fans.
Yeah.
I remember you had, I mean, who was, it was Lenny,
Lenny Bruce.
Lenny Bruce was a big fan of yours.
Yeah. He got this writer, DiCaruso, I think, was doing most of the writing. He used to write for several stand-up comics, and then he got involved with Sick, and he stayed with Joe for a long time. He wrote a lot of the stuff. But Joe was so easygoing. He was so much fun to be with. I mean, I was living in Pennsylvania one time, and I got a script which I didn't care for. And I called Joe. I said, this isn't funny. This doesn't work. He said, well, why don't you write it yourself? And I said, you're kidding. He said, no, write it. Write up the dialogue. Send it to me. I'll set up the balloons and the type or whatever. And we'll do that. So I did. I sat down and as I drew it, and it turned out to be one of my early television takeoff type things that I did later for Mad. But he just said, and when he got the job, he said, it's fine, it's funny, it's terrific. I'm glad you did it. You know, but I said, I don't want to ever do it again, Joe. But it was another funny thing I'm going to bring up because I always thought it was funny. When I was working on The Fly one time, I was sitting with Al Williamson, and Al said, we have to get Joe to write a sidekick for The Fly, and we have to call it Zipper. I said, you're kidding. He said, no, let's talk to Joe about that. And we never did. I never brought it up to Joe, but I always wonder what his reaction would have been to that one.
Wasn't there... Oh, sure.
Angela, wasn't there a story... Joe idolized Al Williamson.
Yeah.
Wasn't a story that Al did something and Joe did not like the layout or something?
Yeah.
And you ended up, you said you would do it, you would redo it.
Yeah, I know. You know, this story is out there.
Why don't you tell that?
I don't remember all the details, but it's been told so many times, it probably did happen. apparently, Al turned in the pencils and Joe didn't care for them. and he said, I want you to do it, you know, wanted me to do it. So I took it back, and I had Al pencil it. And we brought the pencils in, and he said he loved them. It was fine. They were Williamson pencils anyway.
Now this guy can draw.
Yeah, this is the story that's out there, and I wish Al was alive. I'd like to give him a call and find out all the details, but I don't remember any of the actual details of that. But that's a story that is out there now.
Yeah. Now, Paul, I'm going to come back to you in a second, but Emily has a great story about the creation of a new character here.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, he was pretty much creating characters up until the end, although they weren't published. I remember this one time, he was 97 at the time, and he had a cold, no big deal. And he referred to it as the sniffles. So we all start laughing, you know, whatever. And he goes, sniffles, that sounds like it could be a comic book character. So it's just so funny how, like, seriously, up until the very end, he was still coming up with these things. And he was just pretty much the most amazing person I've ever known. I really miss him a lot.
Not only that, he had such respect for the art that he would always be at the drawing board reworking something that he was drawing, and he would finish it. Next day, he'd sit down at the drawing board and say, no, this is wrong. Draw it again, get this perspective right. He loved what he did, and he loved the people who were in the business. Well, at least the artists and writers.
Yeah, he had a little bit of a different opinion sometimes of the publishers. But that's why he was one of the first guys he got a royalty for Captain America in 1940. And he's the guy who took the idea of romance comics to the guys at Crestwood. And they said, okay, we'll give you a page rate, we'll give you the normal stuff. And he said, no, we're going to take half. And they're like, what? And he said, no, we're going to take half. And the idea was he and Jack had come up with such great stuff that they were ready to take it to somebody else. And the guys at Crestwood were basically like, okay, you're going to get half. And there's a really great story where the guys who took Sick Magazine were going to sell it. And they were ready to just go out and sell it to somebody else. And Joe said, okay, so what's my percentage? And they said, well, you're working for us, so nothing. And he's like, what? And he went home, and he's ready to give up. And Harriet, his wife, basically said, wait a minute, find that letter you originally sent to them. And he did. And it said that we've agreed that you will publish our magazine. And he established ownership. And he went back to those guys and basically said, so now we'll figure out what piece maybe you guys will get. And he won. I mean, that was his. And Joe is the reason that every Captain America comic book and two movies now say Captain America created by Joe Simon and Jack Kirby. He looked out for Jack Kirby, and there are a bunch of copyrights out there today that the Kirby estate would not have except that they were Simon and Kirby.
And he had to fight to
get Jack Kirby co-credit on that movie.
He did, and he did that fight. Paul, I mean, you knew both Joe and Jack, so, I mean, it is something maybe you could add to that.
Well, there's a couple of pieces to it. I mean, one is that it's very rare to be a talented creative person and a talented business person. It always struck me that one of the excuses for my limitations as a comic book writer was that a large portion of my brain had been occupied by the part that was a businessman and a publisher, and that, that's probably why I was just okay as a comic book writer. But really in the golden age of comics, you were dealing with these guys who had also no education. They had no reference point for any of it. So there were, out of that whole crowd of guys, really only two solid, forward-thinking businessmen, Will Eisner and Joe Simon. Joe Kubert sort of comes the next tier down, is kind of taking care of himself and working in other people's models that are preset. But both Will and Joe really were ages ahead in the models they were looking at, betting on themselves for copyright, And, you know, you traded a lot for that. It wasn't like you got a royalty just because you asked. You went in, you negotiated. In the case of Simon and Kirby, Joe had built up a tremendous reputation for the studio. Jack, extraordinarily talented man, incredibly diligent, hardworking man, never a businessman by any form or description. That just wasn't what he did. Joe was that part of the team. He went out, he sold the projects, he went out and negotiated the deals, he went out and managed that part of the relationships with the publishers. And he was out there doing, marketing the team as a brand name. And they really became the first talent in this field to be heralded on the cover of a comic as a brand doing something. Some of the earliest royalty deals, I don't think Captain America was the first royalty deal in the field, but probably was the first big fight between a publisher and talent over royalties that were in dispute, let's put it that way. And Joe was a very calm man by comparison to Jack. And Jack is this little spark plug of an excitable guy. Very rarely pissed, but when he was pissed, he was pissed. Joe was able to calmly negotiate through these things. I can certainly, having watched him negotiate, having been involved in at least one cleaning up one problem that had existed since before I was born, with him, he was really solid at it. He just knew his ground. He stuck to his ground. He knew what he wanted in the process, and it was very sanely put together. These aren't easy problems to solve. When you're dealing with a problem or a disagreement that has literally lasted a lifetime, creative people have tremendous problems working those out. First of all, it's not what they do all day. Second of all, it's often, their life's work and their asset. You look at Joe and Captain America, not to diminish Sick or any of the other many wonderful things he did in his life, this was his most enduring contribution to popular culture. So what happened to that and what recognition he got was precious to him, to his family, to providing for his kids and his grandkids ultimately. Those are hard things to sort out. And he had really one of the best track records of successfully going to battle when he felt it was necessary and reaching good solutions. Mm-hmm. And certainly in terms of his taking care of Jack, this was a partnership that ended in 58 or 59, something
yeah,
like
about,
that.
About that, yeah.
And
not a friendship. Friendship continued.
No, friendship didn't end, but the business partnership, was over in the 1950s. And 50 years later, Joe was still working with literally Jack's grandchildren to say, look, we need to do this, and here's Jack's piece. And taking care of them, whether it was exactly written on paper or not, he was kind of the big brother of the two on the business stuff and fighting the battles.
Actually, it really did continue, because when Joe negotiated the 7-book library deal with Titan Books, Titan paid Joe an advance and royalty on all of the material, including a bunch of stuff that's public domain, but they created it. The bottom line is they created it. And Jack gets a piece of all of those, too. The Kirby estate, thanks to Joe, is getting their portion of the royalties of the advances on all of those books. And that's not common for publishers to give advances and royalties even on public domain material. We're kind of happy to do it, but frankly, Joe was right up until that deal negotiating for the Kirbys and literally just calling them and saying them, you're going to get this money. And it's a joy to see that kind of attention and that kind of loyalty in a business that has been going on for so many years. It is kind of nice to think about Joe, the calm negotiator, isn't it? Someday we should try to imagine what that was like.
Joe was a loving man. I mean, you know, he loved his family. And when I talk about him having tiffs with me, it was small stuff. It, you know, I sometimes make it sound bigger than it is.
Oh, no, sometimes it was bigger. Yeah, it was. This was a 6'3" man with a 6'3" temper at times.
Yeah.
I think that's the height, right?
Yeah, he was 6'3". And one thing I'd like to, I mean, probably a lot of you know this, but we should appreciate these, I don't know what to say to you, these older, the first generation of these comic book artists and writers, even the publishers. These people started in the
1930s.
Yeah. They created a real American art form. They had no road maps. They had nobody to tell them how a comic book should be done. They created something. It was truly creation. You know, and I realized that when I was writing The Comic Book Makers with Joe. And I was it's an amazing thought when you think about it. You know, today, a lot of publishing companies, they have the editors who know what to do, and the publishers. But the old days, they created something from nothing.
Actually, yeah, I mean, when Joe got to New York, he was doing a lot of advertising work. What a lot of people of you, what a lot of you don't realize is that how self-taught he was. If you've seen his autobiography, either The Comic Book Makers or Joe Simon, My Life in Comics, you'll realize that there are incredible stories behind these people. Joe literally went straight into newspaper work, retouching artwork, because back then if you had retouching photographs, because if you had a photograph that showed a little bit too much leg or a little bit too much bosom, you had to cover it up. But you had to cover it up physically with brushes and paint. And that's what he did. He then showed them that he could write. He showed them that he could do cartooning. And he became a journalist, a cartoonist, a photo retoucher. He was able to do all of that. He came to New York after one of the papers up in Syracuse closed down. And he was working on that kind of thing. And this guy who was working at, I think it was McFadden Magazine, said, you know, there's this new business starting, and I know a guy. It's a thing called comic books, and this guy is named Lloyd Jacquet, and he's packaging for these guys. And Joe went over there, and he was immediately given an assignment to write, pencil, ink, and letter a story. And he did a Western, a 10 or 12 page Western, took it in, and they bought it like that. And he was immediately a primary comic book creator for these people. And from that, he got stolen from Jacquet. He did a stint as editor at Fox Comics, and then he got stolen to be the editor of Marvel, the first one ever. He hired this wet-behind-the-ears kid named Stanley Lieber, who used the pen name Stan Lee, and admits to this day that Joe was his mentor. But this is a guy who learned how to do it because he taught himself how to do it and then did it. And it's an amazing thing. They had no template back then. I mean, you know, Dave, you can talk a little bit about how people learn these days and compare it with the way they did back then, maybe. Wow. Think of it as me handing you a telephone and it'll work.
Well, I'm essentially self-taught. You know, I saw something that I wanted to do, and I taught myself how to do it. But it's absolutely true that all of us today, and some of us are even unaware of it, but we're actually standing on the shoulders of giants. As you said, you know, this field didn't exist before that generation, and they figured out how to do it. And all the things that we still do, people like Joe and Jack and Will Eisner and Harvey Kurtzman, they figured out the whole grammar of this and the whole way it should work. And they certainly fired my imagination, as I said, with a few simple images. That was my trajectory set for life. So, I mean, I just have to thank them for their inspiration and for creating something that had never existed before, that has been so transformative.
Now,
Now, on that note, I'd actually like to go to the horse's mouth, and we might think of other terms, but I am going to allow... I got to say, I've only watched these a couple of times. The kids and grandkids are here if you want to watch, but we've got Joe. And so I know exactly how it feels. You want to go back? Okay. But I'm going to show you some Joe. And then, by the way, a couple of you guys are going to win books. And you'll find out more about it when you get done. But we've got a couple of birthday presents for you, because basically this is Joe's birthday. He was born on October 11th, back before, almost before paper had been invented. But it is, it's an astonishing thing. And I'd like to show you a little bit of video of Joe Simon. Bear with me, I don't know how the sound is going to be just because we're working with the microphone. I may hold it down next to the speaker. I need, Dana, could you help me with the sound here a little bit? Doesn't seem to be coming out of the mic or out of the speakers.
Okay, yeah. Okay, let's play it again.
Keep money and warm and light. That was not easy.
Can you hear it?
Of course, sometimes then we're very lean. It's worse than they are today. It was the middle of the depression. At that time, of course, they didn't have these polls where they tell you how much unemployment there is and so on, but it was much worse than today. I had just come in from another newspaper closing, you know, on Celebration. I drove in from Rochester and I ran to Essex. I had everything ready. I had my portfolio samples, and just, you know, get up in the morning, go out and look for work. That was a routine.
Okay.
I was working for newspapers, and newspaper advertising was being challenged by radio advertising. Our newspapers were being shut down, and we had to keep on our feet to keep on the employment line. It was not easy. Of course, the times then were very lean. Worse than they are today. It was the middle of the depression. At that time, of course, they didn't have these polls where they tell you how much unemployment there is and so on, but it was much worse than today. I had just come in from another newspaper closing, you know, on Celebration. I drove in from Rochester.
I'm sorry, I didn't realize I just hit the same one again. I think it's duplicated here. Okay, I see what's wrong. Here we go. Forgive me.
Harlan Crandall was our director for McFadden Magazines. He sent me to, you know, he looked at my manuscript and my portfolio, and he said, you know, there's a new industry coming that's making a name for itself. It's comic books, and I have a friend of mine who's in that business. He packed his comic books for publishers. The friend, Helen P. Lloyd J.K., who was an ex-colonel in the Army, Lloyd J.K. Formed this company, Funnies Incorporated. During the day, he worked for United Features. and at night, like a superhero, he'd turn into a comic book packager. he looked at the portfolio and he says, "Well, you know, we always have a need for stuff. Why don't you do a couple features and we'll sell them for you?" I said, "Good, that sounds great. You know, what can you tell me about these features?" He says, "You come up with a character, come up with an idea, come up with a MO, and we'll sell it." That was it. How many pages? Whatever you come up with. I went home to my room in Haddon Hall and did a Western. I had a writer. I come up with characters. I still don't remember which one it was. I know it was a Western. I know it was 10 pages. That's all I remember about it. JK sold it instantly. He said, "Go do more of them." That was the instructions I had. I had a letter, I had to write it, I had a letter, and I had to ink it, I had to erase the pages, everything. It was a one-man mom-and-pop store.
Steve, is he Marcus here?
I think the goal was to advance financially in the industry. The goal was to be a publisher. The goal was first to be an editor. There was no limit. This was America. We succeeded to a point in all our goals. Back then, we had no artistic goals. We had fun, a lot of fun doing these things. Especially when Jack and I got together. Kirby and Simon got together to work together to come up with new characters and so forth, and new ideas, and we actually led the industry as far as the direction of action and new concepts in comic books, and switching from like romance to horror and two heroes. We went through the whole thing, went through the whole gamut. I don't think anybody else is old enough or has been involved enough to have gone through the same thing that I've gone through. We did lead the industry. I can say it now, I'm old enough.
So, we had another panelist who was delayed, but I want to just give him a chance to come up and have maybe a last word of perspective, because this is a gentleman named Mark Waid, who had a very long stint in Captain America. This stuff happens. Just tell us a little bit about what Joe meant for you, and then I'm going to give a couple of you books.
Again, my apologies. It's my fault I got the time wrong, and I apologize. I was honored to have been asked to have been here. I actually had remarks prepared, and I've blown it. I had the great luxury of meeting Joe once. Brian Augustin and I went to his studio once about 20 years ago. Spent the evening with what I had expected to be a fairly dry recitation of comics history, and instead what we got was Joe at full energy talking about not the old days, which Brian and I kept trying to goad him into talking about, but instead about all his new ideas for characters, about all the new stuff he wanted to show us. And we both found that phenomenal. I mean, he was like a little boy, just leaping out of his chair and going through the filing cabinet and finding new concepts. And the sketch he came up with the other day for some new character, and what do you guys think about this? And it was just a delightful way to spend an evening. You know, the passage of Joe was heartbreaking because there was a guy who was there at the beginning of comics, was there at the very beginning. And he was entire life, in every decade, he was able to contribute something meaningful and something of import and lasting to the medium. I don't really have anything more to say than that, and I'm sure that you guys have said much more eloquent things in my absence, for which, again, I apologize.
That's pretty damn good.
Hey, so, but there you go. Steve, I take it.
Well, I mean, it was an honor to know him. He was my friend. it was an amazing thing until the very end. We worked together. We worked on the autobiography. I still remember him going over page after page, making the corrections, showing us what needed to be done. It was just an astonishing thing. I want to recognize one other person briefly, and then I'm going to tell you how you get the books. But Harry Mendrick, please stand up. This is the man who's been restoring the work for the Simon Fisher Library. And he was an amazing person for Joe. He was a good friend, and he's a great person. So, you know, you owe him tremendously. I have no idea why this microphone is acting up. But I will say that it was just such an honor to know him. I do hear Joe's voice saying, "Don't forget to tell him you got the books at the booth." So we got books, his books at the booth if you want to come by the Titan booth. But most of all, I just want to say that it was an honor. It was a pleasure. And as you file out, look under your chairs, because four of you have little things stuck under your chairs that say the book that you won. And otherwise, please come by the Titan booth in 800 row. I've got Xeroxes of his newest book. I've got the science fiction book, and we can tell you more stories. Thank you very much. Thank you.